Are the sounds of a sewing machine recognizable to you? If not, that probably speaks to your age. A study done in 2014 at the University of Missouri shows that people in their 20s and 30s have very little knowledge of basic sewing skills like hemming pants or fixing buttons. But recently in Kansas City, a local fashion designer wondered what would happen if she opened up her Crossroads shop for sewing lessons. Would people be interested in that? She put out a call on Facebook, and the response was overwhelmingly, "Yes, please teach us." In a global economy where we can buy clothes so cheap they're practically disposable, what's the interest in these classes really about? I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll start today's show by talking to that designer, Hadley Clark, whose 18th Street shop is called Hadley. Hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks. Welcome to Central Standard.
Great.
So, what inspired you to start asking around about interest in sewing classes?
Honestly, I have always had a full-time job while having my shop on West 18th Street, and I, after 6 years, lost that full-time paying job. And as an artist and being kind of scrappy and having to use all sorts of skill sets, I thought and was asked by a customer if I would ever teach her, and it kind of opened up a place in my mind of an opportunity and put that call out. So, my economics.
Were you surprised by the response?
Completely overwhelmed.
Give us some examples of the kinds of things people had to say on that thread.
Oh, I think body is a big part of it for women.
What does that mean?
Going shopping, quote unquote, and feeling like nothing fits them, these numbers that we ascribe to our body or letters, small, medium, and large, don't fit all of us. And I think,
Yeah, three sizes don't fit everyone. It's shocking.
Exactly. And I think insecurity with body and all of those things that women have, and I do as well, made women want to be able to be more creative and having more of an influence on what they put on their body in the morning.
What else were you hearing?
I have students from the ages of 18 to 60 plus. So it's also women and men who hadn't pulled out that sewing machine that they had been taught by their mother, their grandmother, when they were a small child. And so I'm reintroducing them to the lessons and the skills that they learned years and years and years ago.
Tell me some more about people who are actually showing up. Do you find any of the, I don't know, the things bringing your students to these classes, are any of the reasons surprising or any of the skill sets that already exist surprising to you?
I can't say that I'm surprised by the skill set or the interest, but the sense and the feeling that the classroom creates, this community, this almost therapeutic energy enters in the classroom, and that is something that happens to me when I sew. It is a private practice that I have, but sharing that and to be women or men and concentrating on a singular task together and the stories that that brings up in their lives.
Well, speaking about stories and lives, you're a designer and you construct the garments that you design and sell in your shop. That's in spite of being on the cusp of a generation, at least, that by and large really has no idea how to sew. How did you learn to sew?
I was never formally trained. I grew up in a house with a sewing machine on the kitchen table and a mom on her hands and knees cutting out patterns when we were going to bed at night. And she made our clothes, or my both grandmothers on either side knit sweaters for us.
Like most of your clothes?
My mom, by and large, yes, for economics as well. I grew up in the 80s, and it was cheaper for her and my family to clothe us with that sewing machine we had. But after that is when I was in my late 20s, when I wanted to go and learn and study fashion. So I moved to Paris because I wanted to learn how to construct beautiful garments the correct way. So my formal training comes from Europe.
So when your mom made your clothes, is that a skill that you picked up like by osmosis? You said you weren't officially taught, but did you pick up to some degree how to sew?
I've always had this feeling about myself that I intuitively understood the sewing machine. So I wasn't taught, but I would sew and change and manipulate my own garments. I think I'm also an Aries, so I wanted to do it all by myself. And I'm not into instruction manuals, so I have to learn by figuring it out my own way.
So when your mom was making your clothes, is that something that you enjoyed? Tell me about your relationship to clothing and how it's evolved.
Yes, I was not a fan of homemade clothing, but...
Because you had to wear it?
Because I had to. And I would go to school and I would see the clothing on all of the other girls in my classroom. And I was fascinated by the labels and the things that they had because I didn't have anything that said Benetton or Guess or Esprit on it that was purchased from a store. But I think that ultimately cultivated in me being a person that is not interested in those things as a late teenager and as an adult. I was more interested in my teenage years shopping at thrift stores. When most students and friends of mine would get jobs at the Gap, I got a job at the thrift store.
So why?
I love digging. I love finding. I think I like a challenge in anything that I do. I don't want things just to be presented.
So do you think that that journey that you've had with just different attitudes toward having something special versus having something that's like what everyone else has, do you think that informs why you sew now?
Yes, you're exactly right.
Explain.
You have your body your whole entire life, and how you cover it through osmosis or it creates the way you feel throughout the day, I believe. And that feeling that I was given as a child that I did not appreciate at the time is a feeling that is my norm, is normal for me. So I completely believe.
Like someone made this for me with my measurements, that
yes.
feeling.
Yes, I picked out the fabric. I had that control. And so I've started making children's clothing because I think that's a gift that we should continue to carry on. And I want my nephew to be able to know what that feels like. And I don't think a lot of children these days do.
Why do you think that so many people who, I mean, even if you don't have to make clothing, the idea of sewing as a basic skill, do you think that has changed? Do you think that that is still considered a basic skill?
No.
Why not?
No. Our relationship to clothing and the production of clothing has changed dramatically in the last 15 to 20 years, in a very short period of time, the way we
just
shop.
Just 15 to 20 years, you think?
Yes, that is a fact of how the production of our clothing in China and how it's moved from country and country to get lower and lower prices. So if your garment is $5, it is $5 because they are searching for the lowest labor cost that they can find.
And so this is the time period that overlaps with the loss of that skill, is the time period during which globally constructed garments are available at, for example, $5 a piece.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think even in high schools, most of those programs, I was in home ec. I learned how to sew, I guess, in high school very minimally. But these days, yeah, people don't understand the time and the consideration and mathematics of putting together a garment.
So do you think that the interest now in learning to sew, I mean, we still have a global economy 15 to 20 years into this that doesn't really require that people put their own time and energy into sewing. And in fact, you could even argue that it's not worth your time or money to mend a cheap garment. It makes more sense on some level to just chuck it. But is there an economic argument or sustainability kind of argument for taking up sewing and a reason why that might be of interest right now?
I completely understand the time that people don't have to make their own garments. But no matter whatever year, you're going to buy clothing. And I think it is more economic and better for the environment to buy four pieces that are $100 plus that you could see yourself having. I mean, I'm making purchases right now that I know I will have for the rest of my life. And I think doing that makes more sense than continuing to buy throwaway garments.
Your business model involving handcrafted clothing meant to last and priced accordingly, would you say that it exists outside of that, the sort of clothing economy that exists out there in the mainstream, or is it part of it?
It's definitely on the outside. I do know that when people come into my studio that is a shop and is a school, it is confusing, and they may only see one piece on the rack that is in that style and is in that textile. So a lot of what I do is education, and that's why I added in the sewing aspect to that, because with language, I'm having to communicate why that is important, that that garment exists, and I made that. And it is a political action that I do take every day that I walk into my studio.
What do you think is political about it?
That I am choosing to give another option to people that does not entail hurting people, killing people, using textiles that are bad for the environment. There's so much that goes into these items that we cover our body with that is not good for the environment, and as I said, hurts and kills people. So giving people another option, which is what I do.
Hurts and kills people how?
They are sweatshops in places, especially like Bangladesh right now. The buildings that these sweatshops are held within are not up to code. They have too many people there. In 2013, in April, in Bangladesh, I think 1,100 people died in a collapse of a sweatshop. So that's a real thing that is inside the tag on the T-shirt that you bought for $5 that you have on your body.
Well, if you are taking up sewing or interested in it, call and tell us your story. 816-235-2888. Or if you're part of a generation that's always sewn, what are your observations about youngins who famously can't sew buttons and their growing interest in learning how? 816-235-2888. We're joined now by Danielle Meister, who is with us from a new store in town called We Are Sincerely Yours. She's one of Hadley's students in that sewing class. Danielle, good morning.
Good morning.
Why are you taking this class?
Well, I've been a client of Hadley's for quite a while. I collect her pieces. And when I was a little girl, my mother taught me how to sew, myself and my five younger sisters. And I think that life gets very, very busy. And picking up sewing again was always something that I wanted to do.
So you had kind of lost the skill?
A little bit. I mean, as time goes on, I lost the confidence in it. And there's a bit of fear associated with really wanting to pick something up again and not trusting that you will have a positive outcome. And when Hadley put out the call for interest in her sewing classes, I was just so excited because my mother taught us how to sew, but she didn't necessarily have the tools that Hadley has. And so when I took Hadley's class, I gained so much more confidence. I was able to understand some of the reasons that we do what we do.
Can I jump back and ask you more about just the way you grew up and where sewing fit into that in your household?
Absolutely. Well, I was raised similarly to Hadley. We had a large family in the 80s, and my mom grew up, she was a teenager of the 70s, so she sewed her own clothing. And I was really inspired by that. I remember going through a box of her garments from the 70s that she had made for herself and just being absolutely tickled by that. And so when she taught us to sew, it was a skill set. She also made our clothing, and she wanted us to have that skill set to carry into the world with us.
Do you think that sewing is a necessary skill today? I mean, do you consider that in today's economy, even though you could technically get by not knowing how to do it, a necessity?
I mean, I think there are a lot of things that we learn in our lives that are not necessity based, but that they improve the quality of our life. And I think that sewing right now is probably one of those skills that can greatly improve the quality of one's life.
How?
Well, the power that it gives you in being able to confidently hem a pant for yourself, or to sew on a button, or to give that skill to somebody else, and in sort of a caretaking way, you know, it's been my great pleasure to be able to show a woman younger than me how to use a needle and thread, which is something that I just take for granted.
What do you think appeals to younger generations about sewing? I mean, people taking it up, again, like as you've said, not really out of necessity.
Sure. Well, I think that right now, you know, we talk a lot about how this current generation is investing more in experiences and less in things. And the experience of sewing is just sort of, to piggyback on something Hadley said, taking that class and being with that group of people and achieving this common goal together, it's a community building experience.
Tell me more about your own background with clothing and sewing, because sure, it goes beyond just how you grew up, right?
Yes. I think that having an introduction to the construction of garments from my mother, and that sort of fanned the flames of my fascination with the world of fashion. I've always been very interested in the story that different designers tell, and I think have my knowledge of the construction of garments sort of made me even more interested. And so I went to school for fashion merchandising. And then I was a merchandiser in corporate retail for many years.
Corporate retail.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name the kinds of places where you worked?
Sure. I worked for the Guess store in the 90s. I worked for the Gap.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think that places like that play, what role do they play in what we do and don't know about sewing and what we do and don't want in clothing? Like, mm-hmm. Because part of what these stores do isn't just providing what we want. In some ways, it's telling people what they want.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's interesting, and I've totally participated in this, shopping as this experience. And so it's entertainment to go shopping. And so somewhere like the Gap or the Guess store or what have you, they're creating for you this experience, this space to be entertained in, and to consume something that fits into that category of entertainment.
Yeah, it's like there's like a wish fulfillment part of it. You just brought back to my memory, speaking of the 80s, like the mm-hmm. scene in Pretty Woman where Julia Roberts goes around like filling her bags with all the stuff that she couldn't have before. And there's this idea of like, this would be sort of a great accomplishment, or to look a certain way, to have that certain stuff.
Yes, I think that for many, many years, I participated in the world in a way where, and I still do, I fall into this quite easily, it's very habitual, but the idea that accumulating stuff, a thing, an object, particularly an article of clothing, that it will somehow create you, that will somehow change your life in some way, that it will make you, and I, you know, in my current lifestyle, I really I try to proceed throughout the world as if it's not one thing that's going to make me or create me. That belongs to me. That power is within myself. So learning something, achieving something, doing something, as opposed to consuming something, I think is of great value.
Could you, when you put that time and care into mending something, are there things that are, quote, like worth it and things that are not worth it?
That's a funny question because in my store, I've naturally, because I sell secondhand and vintage and then some higher end designers, I've naturally forayed into hemming and altering garments for my clients. And I've had that question, you know, even with some embarrassment, a client will ask me to mend something that maybe wasn't, you know, a very costly garment. And I think that it has more to do with the value that you place on the object, if it makes you feel good, if it fits you well, and if it's something that you want to invest that extra time and care into.
Is there a garment that has had special meaning in your life that comes from something other than the price tag?
Oh, several. But probably... the one that is hanging on the wall in my shop right now is it's a antique wedding kimono from Japan, made in the 1920s, that I bought to wear over my wedding dress. And it's just a beautiful object. And it meant a great deal to me to collect it and to preserve it and to get to wear it.
Why? What was meaningful about that to you?
Well, I think that the feeling that it gave me was very meaningful. The object itself is very beautiful. It's not really just a garment. It's a work of art. I mean, it's a beautiful object. And I like the story behind it. You know, I like that it was worn by another woman somewhere, likely in Japan in the 1920s, on her wedding day. And I don't know who she was, but... I don't know, the nostalgia of that is important to me.
I'm curious from both of you, Danielle and Hadley, I mean, do you think that interest in a story of a garment or the longevity of a garment, the personal touch behind it, do you think that it is a fringe thing, maybe even a privileged thing, or do you see it as possibly growing into a larger movement? What do you observe around you?
I don't think it's just for privileged people. I think we all have our own set of eyes and have been raised with objects that enhance that view that we have. So I don't know if it's a movement, but I think the consciousness of this is raised. We're talking about it today, which is really spectacular. These are the kinds of conversations I want to have.
I see what you're saying.
And I'm not even trying to say anything. I'm really just curious about whether this is a small segment of the population that either can or wants to do this, or if you're seeing a broader like groundswell.
Sure. Well, from my perspective, I feel I am seeing a broader groundswell. I feel like I am seeing more interest in this conversation. I think that mending and preserving garments is an economic thing to do. So from my perspective, I don't think it's a privileged action. I think it's even one that is born out of economic stress.
We have to take a short break, but when KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear about a company that has local women taking the economics of the clothing industry into their own hands. The story of Rightfully Sewn in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about an economic, environmental, and cultural interest in moving away from mass-produced clothing toward making and mending garments by hand. If you're taking up sewing or interested in it, call and tell us why. Tell us your story at 816-235-2888. Or if you're part of the generation that's always sewn, what are your observations? I want to talk now with Godfrey Riddle. He is with us from a local business getting a lot of buzz. It's called Rightfully Sewn. Hi, Godfrey.
Hi, Gina.
What is Rightfully Sewn? What do you guys do?
So we are a nonprofit organization, and we've been around since about 2015. And our mission is twofold. We're focused on helping at-risk women develop the skills to become seamstresses and claim living wage jobs in Kansas City's garment manufacturing industry.
What do you mean by at risk? At risk of what?
So these are women that would be program participants at organizations like Catholic Charities, Hope Faith Ministries. So they are coming from situations of domestic violence. Some are coming from low-income backgrounds, and some are new arrivals or new citizens in America, so coming from refugee situations in other countries.
So people really looking for and needing more economic independence.
Absolutely. One of the things that we learned when we were beginning our operation is that women from these at-risk backgrounds, one of the key factors in enabling them to escape that situation and build brighter futures is the ability to have a stable stream of income that's theirs, that they can rely on, and it also gives them that sense of hope and pride to heal from that situation.
And so you were saying that this is a sort of multi-pronged, like threefold company?
Absolutely. So there are two parts. So the first part is helping those at-risk women, training them, helping them with job placement. And then secondly, we work with local fashion designers to help incubate them and elevate their businesses through training, sponsorship opportunities, promotion, all those things.
You know, in some of the materials promoting Rightfully Sewn talk about the importance of what you call scalable fashion manufacturing in mid-sized cities like Kansas City. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think Kansas City is the perfect example. We actually have a really rich history with garment manufacturing. In the 1950s, it was actually the second largest employer across any industry in Kansas City. And we're home to the largest dress manufacturer in the entire world. So we know that we're not alone in that rich history, and that there are individuals like Hadley and other designers out there looking to scale up their businesses. But one of the challenges is the fact that they don't have access to skilled seamstresses. So by training these at-risk women, we're helping them get on their feet and build financially stable futures, but also helping designers expand their businesses. So we know that we can do that in other similar sized cities like Columbus, and even Toronto, Canada has a similar market to Kansas City for that fashion manufacturing and growth.
Tell me about yourself and your personal relationship to this stuff. I mean, was the company's mission in some way personal for you? Is that where your interest in this comes from?
Absolutely. So I am a proud ambassador of Rightfully Sewn, but Jennifer Latka Pfeiffer is the founder. And this was born out of her love for fashion and her experience with sewing. She actually grew up sewing. Her grandmother taught her. And through that love, that passion, and also her work at a few foundations around town, she was able to discover that there is a need for trained, you know, skilled seamstresses. There are actually about 88 jobs open, and people are struggling to fill those with skilled labor, and a need for these at-risk women to build financial independence. So that's really why she started the organization. And I was attracted to it because I love fashion. I love the arts. I've been in the arts community here for a number of years, and I also really love the idea of women's empowerment and helping women who have faced so much trauma in their life really heal from that and find a way to build independence and protect themselves from those situations in the future.
Do you know how to sew?
I wish. I've been working on it. I have sewn, I've hand sewn. When I was younger, my mom taught me how to stitch a garment, but that's about it.
just how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
Oh, no problem at all. I am 28, freshly minted.
So, I mean, among your friends and people you know, do you see, like, what you would call widespread interest in learning how to sew?
I do, and I would say it's a widespread interest because of the whole concept of conscious consumerism. I know Hadley mentioned earlier the factory collapses that have happened in Southeast Asia, in particular Bangladesh. And I think that people are beginning to become more aware of what it means to have that $5 garment, and we're not comfortable with it. So Rightfully Sewn is an opportunity to both support at-risk women, but also help individuals who want to have you know, rightfully sewn or ethically made garments to do that and really capitalize on that need and that growing niche in the fashion industry.
Well, Godfrey, hang out with me for a minute. I mean, I want to get back to Hadley Clark and Danielle Meister, who have been talking with us earlier. Has anything Godfrey said, like, do you need to chime in and help us understand what this means, you know, either to our local economy or just local consumers?
Yes. In 2011, freshly graduated from fashion school, I attended a trade show and I would need to have garments made with the help of someone else. And so I started talking to a factory somewhat close to the Kansas City area, and I showed them garments that I was making, and they had thought I had invented stitches that were basic stitches that I had learned at school. So I soon learned I wouldn't be able to work with them. So yes, being a maker and a designer and having access to trained seamstresses in that way is a huge gift to our city.
You know, we keep using the word seamstress, and we're talking about helping women learn a skill. The history of sewing, at least, you know, I mean, in the home and also just who has been a dressmaker, who has been in this trade, it's very gendered. Is that still the case? And is that at all interesting to you, Hadley?
I don't think it's gendered. I think we're moving into a direction that we have non-gendered disciplines and people all over. So I think it's just a general interest. I have many students where their fathers are the ones who ran the sewing machine in the home. So I think it just depends on how you grew up.
Let's talk to a caller. We've got Angie with us from Overland Park. Hi, Angie.
Hi.
What can you share?
Well, I just wanted to share that I was very enthusiastic when I heard that your topic today was sewing. I come from a long line of home sewers, of women who sewed, both making quilts. I have some quilts that my great-grandmother made probably in the early 1900s, maybe even in the late 1800s. I myself am 66. I learned to sew in the second grade when I was in 4-H. And I think in my generation, that was a real common way to move into sewing.
4-H was?
Kid in 4-H, right. And I wasn't a farm kid, so I started out hemming a handkerchief by hand with little, very short, you know, running stitches. And progressed from there to making my own clothing. Although I didn't sew a whole lot as a teen, my mom still sewed for me. Her mother made dresses, beautiful matching dresses for my mom and my sister and myself. And her father actually had worked in a tailor shop. And so there's a lot of sewing history in my family. And over the years, I looked back at my own experience of sewing, and I realized it was so much more than just the garments that I made. I've particularly sewn a lot when I was at times in my life where I was at home alone with babies or my children were little, where we had just moved, where perhaps I was isolated. And the creativity and the time that I spent sewing, as well as the garments that I made, were very, very satisfying to me. It's very, very creative. It just filled a whole creative space for me. And because I'm short, I'm less than 5 feet tall now, but I've always had to somewhat alter ready-made clothes that I have purchased. So it's also nice that I can make some of my own things and I can make them fit.
Thank you, Angie. You know, Hadley, you were mentioning before that sewing is meditative, and that sounds maybe like something Angie is echoing here, talking about the just personal fulfillment she got from constructing garments.
Exactly. Being able to have something that you made with your own two hands and to be able to look at and wear and have around your home is a magical thing, especially in these times that we live in.
Let's talk to Howard about his story with sewing. Hi, Howard.
Hello. When I was in the sixth grade in the early 1960s, the Kansas City public school system, boys had to take a semester of home economics, where, you know, they between cooking and sewing, and I think it's an absolutely excellent idea. And also, and with my immediate family, my paternal grandparents, they worked in the sweatshops in New York in the 1920s and 30s. And my paternal grandfather, he worked at Bunce Clothing. He was quite a tailor. He worked at Bunce Clothing in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. And he took care of some Kansas City notables like Tom Pendergast and Jim Monroe and others.
Took care of. Not as a euphemism there, but more he sewed for them.
I hope you're going to do that. And I like to know, what does a decent sewing machine cost these days? Something simple to take care of simple jobs. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Howard. So Howard's looking for some practical advice on, you know, the basics, how to get himself a sewing machine.
Yes, there's a basic Brother machine that I recommend to my beginning students. It's about $150 new. Missouri Sewing Machine Company on Truman, and they have other locations in Johnson County. They have great machines, used machines for under $200, so I always go and check out what they have as well.
Do you think that it's a worthwhile investment? I mean, financially, to go and get a sewing machine versus going and spending some money on some clothing?
I do. I mean, Halloween comes once a year. I know that's a necessity around my house.
I think it is absolutely a great investment. And Missouri Sewing Company is so wonderful because they're so knowledgeable. And so that investment continues. They will help you learn how to care for your machine, and they will fix anything that is needed.
Well, thank you, Danielle Meister, Hadley Clark, and Godfrey Riddle for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, spinning yarns on the storytelling stage. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, today kicks off the National Storytelling Network's big annual conference here in Kansas City. This year's theme is All Our Voices, Stories of Immigration and Migration. And we're joined by Susan O'Halloran, who's here in town for the conference. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Me too. Well, you started a group called Race Bridges, and we're going to get into that. But I'm curious about your background, how you got into storytelling.
I got in a little circuitous route. I was a professional dancer, and I broke some discs in my back and unfortunately couldn't dance any longer. And I saw a storyteller, and everything inside of me said, I could do this. And you know that intuitive feeling that this is right for you. I could be on stage but not leap around it and kill myself. So I just fell in love, and there's so many different kinds of storytelling. You know, you've got folk tales, tall tales, personal narratives. You just can combine movement and voice and narrative, and it just fit me perfectly.
So you were watching a performance when this hit you. Can you tell me about what it was you were seeing and feeling?
Well, I could see the magic. It's like you watch the whole audience turn into a group of three-year-olds. They just get mesmerized.
Like hands in your lap, let's tell a story.
Yeah, there's just something between. It was all adults, and this man was actually telling, I remember I actually asked permission to tell some of the stories that he told that night. He did mostly folk tales, but it just drew people in, and your imagination's running. You know, there's a movie running in your mind, and it's relaxing but also exciting at the same time.
There are different like strains within the storytelling world. There's this a fairly new trend toward telling your own personal story on stage. And what you're talking about when you talk about telling someone else's story or telling a folk tale, that's a really different kind of thing.
Well, we also do personal narrative. I think you're thinking about The Moth and some of those kind of, we do things like that. It's sometimes the difference is they have a format where most of the time it's like 5-minute stories. I tell stories that are an hour and a half long even.
But an still, hour and a half?
Yes, but they're still personal stories. It's like one woman show, right? And like a monologue. But many times those stories are wonderfully structured. The difference is that sometimes they're just more, here's an anecdote about something that happened to me, whereas ours have a clear beginning, middle, end. It has a dramatic arc to it, and we really work at the craft. That's why we're gathering in Kansas City this week, is to learn our craft from each other. How do you use your voice? How do you edit your stories? How do you move music into the story? So it's a real craft that we learn, not that people aren't, sometimes they're wonderfully crafted in some of the bar scenes, The Moth and such on the competition. But we take the structure of the folk story. We take just kind of the mythic structures that have been around forever and apply them to personal narrative. So we do personal narrative too, but it's really an art form.
So when you say we, are you talking about your group called Race Bridges?
Race Bridges is something that I produce, racebridgesstudio.com, where we have over 200 video stories of professional storytellers telling stories around race and ethnicity and diversity and inclusion. We have presented at the National Storytelling Conference, and I will be on an immigration panel using stories about immigration and refugees this Friday morning at the conference. So, and actually, I am shooting 26 new stories at the conference for Race Bridges Studio. And we have lesson plans and other resources teachers, community people can lead. But story is one of the best ways to talk about difficult subjects such as race.
Because, why?
Well, yeah, it goes into people's heart instead of the head. We get out of that debate team mentality of who's right and who's wrong. And suddenly you can relate to somebody's experience. Oh, they had children just like me, or their growing up was like me. And suddenly the empathy and compassion begin to flow.
Is it all? So that's an interesting idea, that you can reach across some kind of cultural divide with a story because of what different people have in common just across cultures. But there are going to be things that are distinctive and different. And does that, just as much as what you have in common has the ability to connect you, is there the possibility that what is different and what isn't like you?
Actually, you have to have both. You have to have how are we different and how are we similar? Because you can't say, I remember when we had a show called More Alike Than Not, Stories of Three Americans, Christian, Jewish, Muslim. And we were going to a mosque, and the folks there at the mosque were a little concerned. Are you going to try to say we're all alike and it's all the same? Because we also love what's unique about us. It was like, of course, you actually disrespect people if you say we're all the same. At the other hand, we don't want to be a bunch of warring separate nations. We want to find out what we have in common. So it's really the two together. I always say you want mirrors and windows. When you listen to the stories, people want mirrors. They want to see reflections of themselves. We have this great community outreach thing going on right now. Trade Winds, which is a wonderful Asian artist organization here in Kansas City, has teamed up with National Storytelling Network, and they're having a concert tonight. You can go to at Grant Hall at UMKC, and it's a wonderful idea that I just keep sitting there. I've been at this conference going with the Asian artist going, that's so different than how I grew up. That's so different. And then at other times you're going, oh my gosh, that's just like my family. And it's really the combination of the two that to me reads as respect.
So why approach it through a personal story? I mean, I guess the idea of a story in service to some big idea or some lesson that we're trying to teach or some like societal good that we're trying to fulfill. I do like that idea, but what about the story for its own sake? I mean, does the story risk becoming maybe pedantic or, you know, like people can tell when you have an agenda.
No, see, that's the art form. I call it teaching without preaching. Not preaching, there's preaching that's an art form that's amazing. But preaching like the finger comes out and wags at you, you never want a story to do that. So you have all these human moments. My Irish grandmother used to say, joke about the serious and be serious about the joking. So you've got to have humor. I mean, this sounds deathly serious. And so, no, it's not. It's funny. People are laughing till they're wiping tears out of their eyes because of the human condition. And so those little moments, in fact, when people say, how do you tell
comic relief?
Comic relief, and also just, oh my gosh, that's so true. And when those truths are spoken, it just touches the heart again, you know, and it connects you to other people. So no, it doesn't get heavy. It's not, doesn't feel like an agenda. That's why you have to work on the craft of it. I get away with saying incredible things. You wouldn't believe what I get away with saying because it's all pitched in human moments.
Can you give me an example?
Well, for instance, I tell a story about taking my kids when they were in their early 20s to Guatemala. And I'm going to go and show them all these people that are working for social justice, inspire them because they grew up after the Watergate. They're kind of cynical kids. And of course, you can tell by the whole setup that I'm going to get my comeuppance. It's really me who learns the most on that trip. But I talk about Guatemala having been a democratic place that the U.S. came in and overthrew the dictator. And there's a number of places where that kind of politics wouldn't be welcome. But I'm in some very conservative audiences that, because I'm talking about my kids and how I'm worried about them and talking about the children and adults we're meeting in Guatemala, they come up to me and say, well, that wasn't right. But I haven't done any preaching or told people what to think. You take people on a journey. You respect them to have their own beliefs. You don't tell them what to believe. I still do a lot of speaking, but that really is how I got into storytelling. I was doing some speaking, and I thought, I don't want to tell people what to think. I want to respect that they're intelligent beings and can come to their own conclusion. So the story leads people, but there's a free will that I love about storytelling, because you tell the same story and there's 200 people in the audience, there's 200 different meanings going on.
Tell me about yourself as an audience member for stories. I mean, you're talking about the things that you've gotten away with saying to audiences that you don't think would be receptive to those ideas because you've told it as a personal story. What about yourself? Have you been surprised by an experience you found yourself relating to because of the story someone told and the way they told it?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. I'm just thinking, for instance, on our Race Bridges studio site, and tonight, if people will come to Grant Hall at 7 o'clock for the Asian Artist Conference, and also at the Marriott, the Healing Arts Alliance for NSN is also having a concert. You sit there, and I'm thinking of this moment, Brenda Wong Aoki talking about a woman on the trains to the incarceration camps when Japanese Americans were rounded up. And she has her baby there who had been in the hospital, and they took the baby out of the hospital in this long train ride in the heat. And everybody in the train knows the baby has died, but the mother will not face it. And she actually hops off the train trying to find a doctor for a baby. She's like wandering through the desert with this baby in her arms going, where's the doctor? Where's the doctor? Now, you don't have to say this was very traumatizing for people to get incarcerated. We should have a redress movement for Japanese Americans losing their homes and their work. You talk about a moment of a mother losing her baby, and you're just, you know, I mean, you're so emotionally involved. And there's a million of those, especially on our racebridgesstudio.com site, because people are telling stories. We've been so segregated in this country that I didn't know that's how somebody else grew up. I didn't know their family faced that issue where they all had to run from their farm because they were afraid of the KKK or whatever. So it's been eye-opening. And to me, the most wonderful way to learn, because it's so darn entertaining.
That is interesting because, you know, we talk a lot today about how people are isolated in little bubbles, you know, even down to the news they consume, you know, where you live and who you're around and what your existing ideas are so likely to shape what information you even reach out to grab or know exists out there, you know, let alone who you're talking to, who you're interacting with. Is it possible? I mean, you aren't in control of who's in your audience. How do you? You're talking about segregation and bridging experiences from that have been separated over the past. How do we bridge audiences and stories today?
It's the same thing. You know, you have human things in common. Now, sometimes I do get to know my audience to an extent. I'm hired by an association or a business, and I'll do a lot of research as I can and even talk to audience members sometime if I can ahead of time. But otherwise, you just figure you're going to have people all over the map, and so you're looking for those common denominators so that you can reach. And you're reading people on stage. That's the beautiful thing about storytelling. It's live.
Thank you so much, Susan. Susan O'Halloran founded Race Bridges. She's here for the National Storytelling Network's annual conference happening this weekend at the Marriott on the Plaza. And our time is up. You can listen back to this conversation and our other conversation this morning about sewing at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, what do we expect from higher education? Is college supposed to prepare us for the job market, give us a return on our investment through social capital? Or is it about something fuzzier, more philosophical? Join that discussion tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next. Don't miss it.